This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is It Was a Thing on TV.
Spoiler number one is Dr. Lee Franz. It stinks.
What is going on? What is going on?
Episode 39, Submission 589, Nightstand with Dick Dietrich. Nightstand with Dick Dietrich aired in syndication from September 16th of 1995 through September of 1997 for 96 half-hour episodes or 48 hour-long episodes.
Tonight on Nightstand,
can I say masturbation?
Obviously you can.
Intercourse on the internet. What would happen if your computer broke?
Well, it has gone down on me a couple of times.
Then...
You suck, Dietrich!
Nightstand fulfills some of your dreams.
Believe it or not, I'd love to be a talk show host.
Well, keep dreaming.
Cyber sluts, cyber studs, and Charlene Tilton.
Unbelievable.
On Nightstand, where comedy doesn't get any more better. And now, the host of Nightstand, Dick Dietrich.
Thank you very much.
Guys, I'm sure you remember back in the mid-90s, there were talk shows galore. Not only did you have Phil Donahue sort of coming to an end at the time, not only did you have Oprah, not only did you have Sally Jesse Raphael, but also you had some future installments like the Tempest Bledsoe Show. You had Jim Jay and Tammy Faye, also a future installment. You had even Mark Wahlberg having a show in the mid-1990s. But one talk show that was the best out of all of them, not Richard Bay, was Nightstand with Dick Dietrich.
You mean it's not Richard Bay?
Everything should be Richard Bay.
Richard Bay on his own merits was a good show. But Nightstand with Dick Dietrich was, it was in a class of its own.
Yes.
It was a spoof of talk shows. And the people behind Nightstand with Dick Dietrich would go on to bigger and better things in the future. It was created by Paul Abeda, Peter Keiko, and Timothy Stack. And you may be saying, who are those folks? Well, Abeda and Keiko also went on to do another future installment, Burt Ludden's Love Buffet. But also, they did another little show called MXC, the Most Extreme Elimination Challenge. Another show that's near and dear to our hearts. Say it, Greg.
Rob Tusson, Never Forget. Yeah, all you people who watch MXC, you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yes. And all the Baba Ganoush. Every single Baba Ganoush on that show.
Yep.
So Dick Dietrich was portrayed by Timothy Stack, who was one of the creators, as we mentioned. But also Timothy Stack was a decent actor in his own right. He made some guest appearances in the 80s and early 90s. But he would have later success on a little show on FX back in the early 2000s called Son of the Beach. Almost said Son of the Beach. Son of a Beach. Son of the Beach. Son of the Beach. And so Nightstand was, as I said, just a takeoff of talk shows, but it went beyond that. They used themes very similar to talk shows, talking about aliens, talking about relationships, talking about, I mean, anything you could think of that would be a reasonable talk show topic. And the big thing about this show was just all the play on words, the different gags, the double entendres. Now, I don't know about you guys. In this area, Nightstand aired at midnight on Saturdays. Did it air about that time in your areas, if you remember?
I don't remember if it ever aired in the Raleigh-Durham area. All I remember is the first time I've ever seen it, it was already running in reruns on E.
Yeah, same here. It probably would have aired here in New York, but yeah, first time I can recall seeing it was on E.
Okay, the reason I mention that is because at that time, it aired on Fox here, on the Fox station, at midnight, immediately after Mad TV, which had just premiered not too much earlier than the start of Nightstand. That was must-see TV for me. I'm sorry. Saturday Night Live at that time was getting progressively worse, and Mad TV was absolutely hilarious at that time. And then you've got Nightstand immediately after it. This is like the greatest 2 hours of television to this then early 20-something. Now, you see, you wouldn't have seen it, Greg, because you would have been like 10 years old. You would have been too young.
What? No, 95 would have been 11. I would have been 11.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was off by a year. You still wouldn't have seen it.
I was staying up at 11 o'clock at night on Saturday night. Like, come on.
The show itself, it sort of resembled Springer in a way. Again, like I said, they're very salacious topics. But also, there was an assistant. His name was Miller. And he was not unlike Richard Dominick on Jerry Springer's show at the time, where he'd be behind a podium running the show, and sometimes Jerry Springer would make a reference to him and they'd show him on camera. Miller was the same way. He was behind the podium producing the show, and sometimes Dick Dietrich would make a comment or say something, and you'd sort of see Miller shrugging it off. So there were many parallels to different talk shows here. Another frequent character on this show was played by character actress Lynn Marie Stewart, who's been on a ton of shows. She was just known as the audience member, and she'd appear in almost every episode and would be the audience member to ask a staged question. She was planted in the audience and would ask a stage question, which would elicit some type of reaction. Usually it's a double entendre or a play on words. And the rest of the audience, who was a regular audience, would laugh. They would find it hilarious. So you had one person planted in the audience among a real live studio audience, which is great. And the show did have some recurring guests. There was a guest that appeared frequently named Bob, who was involved in various depraved endeavors.
The interesting thing about Bob, he was played by Christopher Darga. And a person who auditioned for the role of Bob was Vic Wilson. Where would we see Christopher Darga and Vic Wilson later?
Ooh, can I answer?
Go.
Go ahead.
They would voice Vic Romano and Kenny Blankenship on the aforementioned MXC.
Yes!
Nice!
This is like one giant family. A Beta, Keiko, and you've got Christopher Darga and Vic Wilson. There was magic there between MXC and Nightstand with Dick Dietrich. So another semi-recurring character on the show was the Astounding Andy, who was a hypnotist slash magician, and he was played by actor Steve Valentine, who would later be on the show Crossing Jordan. But also, he made some other appearances on TV shows. He was on Married with Children around this time as a moviegoer who, once he found out he was attending a movie, I believe it was Bridges of Madison County, he sort of like ran into the street into oncoming traffic. He didn't want to be known for being seen at Bridges of Madison County. But you wanted to add something, Chico.
Yeah, he would also be on the two future installments. He would be the host of A State of Panic, and he would be a guest voice on G versus E.
A State of Panic. That was a great show, and he was a perfect host for that. Good call there.
He was. Fun fact about Steve Valentine. He said he played a magician named the Astounding Andy. He is a real-life magician.
I did not know that. Also a recurring guest who played a doctor on a number of episodes was Ron Glass. And if that name rings a bell, he was a character, a supporting character on Barney Miller. He had a longer career than just that, but that's probably where you'd know him from best.
It seems like the bigger the name, the less episodes that they appear in. For example, I remember there was actually an episode with ants on it. He was only on one episode.
Yeah, I remember ants. He was a thing in comedy back in the late 90s. Well, he lasted longer than the late 90s because he was on, what show was he on?
Celebrity Fit Club?
Something beyond that. Wasn't he on, I think he was on an early season of Last Comic Standing.
He was on an early season of Last Comic Standing.
So he had a decent career.
And he was also on an episode of Son of the Beach.
There you go. But also, they did have occasional guest stars, real-life guest stars. They had Morgan Fairchild, Rodney Dangerfield, Gary Marshall, I remember, was on an episode. A name that may not be familiar, but again, was somebody in radio at the time, Mancow. Mancow was sort of like a poor man's Howard Stern, if you will.
Yes, he'll come up again when we discuss the Eagle Man ad, when we do, ever we do that local commercials episode.
And
you all know what I'm talking about if you've ever seen that Eagle Man commercial.
I know what you're talking about. Oh my gosh, the Eagle Man commercial. Oh jeez.
And also, I have something for you.
Oh no, Greg, stop it. I haven't seen this in about 20 years, but I know exactly what you're doing.
Oh boy.
Yeah, Mancow was sort of a light shock jock in Chicago back in the 90s. And also, Jerry Springer was on an episode. Harry Anderson was. Jimmy Walker was. So it was a decent lineup of guests. But the big thing that really made the show was it was a combination of the timing of the delivery of the jokes, but also just the puns and double entendres. And Dick Dietrich, anytime he would say something, a double entendre, and the audience would react, ooh!
Right.
There you go. Anytime they'd react like that, you'd hear Dick Dietrich, I'll let him say it.
Pathetic. We're talking about the furry little creature.
No, people. No, 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 no. And ultimately, in the end of each episode, it really sort of was treated like a real talk show. There'd be resolution. You know, the couple would get back together, or you know, there would be the divorce or whatnot. So it actually played out like a real life talk show, but it was a parody in and of itself. Absolutely hilarious. And as we mentioned earlier, it was on E! For quite a few years. I didn't know it was actually on E! For more or less 4 years. I'm absolutely shocked by that. But also, I'm sort of shocked that it's not even on TV anymore. You can't find it on Prime. There's a couple episodes on YouTube. It's a darn shame because this was probably one of the funniest shows, if not of the 1990s, of all time, in my opinion. So one of the production companies behind Nightstand with Dick Dietrich was Big Ticket Television, also known as Big Ticket Entertainment or Big Ticket Pictures. And their first TV show they did was Nightstand with Dick Dietrich. But they would go on to much bigger and better things. Shortly after Nightstand with Dick Dietrich premiered, there would be a little show on UPN, which they produced, called Moesha. But then the following fall, in fall of 1996, they really hit the big time with a TV show, which is sadly going to be ending in the next year to year and a half, Judge Judy. But also on top of that, they did Judge Joe Brown. They also have done Hot Bench. So they've gotten around and have had shows which have been very popular. So they must be doing something right.
Yep. Oh, an interesting thing about Big Ticket. One of the people who founded it, Larry Little, he wanted to name the company Blockbuster Television after driving past the Blockbuster. Blockbuster, by the way, would be at this point owned by Paramount and Viacom and all of that. But ultimately, Viacom opposed the idea because they didn't know what the fate of Blockbuster would be at this time. So he just called it, well, what about that Big Ticket logo? Big Ticket Television. Now it's owned by CBS Television Studios, a division of Viacom CBS.
Did you guys have any opinions about the shows, if you saw any online?
Well, I saw a lot of it online, and I thought it was really well produced, and I thought it was one of those shows. I remember watching it when I was like 16, 17 years old and thinking to myself, no way this could be real. How is this possibly real? It wasn't real.
Yeah, same thoughts Chico had. It was a very entertaining show. And
you didn't even mind it wasn't real. It was just, it just captured the feeling of trash talk of the day.
Yeah, and it was a very off-the-wall show, too.
And, you know, the people who were behind it were known for off-the-wall television. A couple of the writers, Larry Strother, Jim Drake, you know what they worked on, Mike?
Can I say it again?
You can say it again.
MXC, the most extreme...
Okay, another show. Another one of your favorite shows.
Burt Lund's Love Buffet?
Night Court.
Oh, Night Court. Yes, 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 yes. And that's where a lot of the humor, you can see a lot of the Night Court humor on Nightstand with Dick Dietrich.
Yes, you can.
I do want to talk about one incident that is mentioned on Our Favorite Truth by Consensus Wikipedia. There was an episode in 1995 called Love on the Internet. Boy, that never goes well. Love on the Internet.
No.
Oh, no.
This is an episode they can play today.
Sadly, you're right. There's one scene that unexpectedly went a little too far when Dick Dietrich tore the clothes off a male model named Cal to see if he could impress an uninterested young female guest who was looking for a date.
On the internet.
Yeah, the problem is after ripping off the shirt, the model's trousers were next, and Stack accidentally pulled the model's underwear down as well. As a result, there was a brief and unscripted glimpse of male nudity, much to the shared shock of the audience and the performers. And supposedly this appears every now and then on blooper and outtake shows. I've never seen this. I've never heard of it. I remember the episode, though, because, one of the things that Dick Dietrich did was rip off the model of the shirt so you saw his bulging biceps and muscular body. But obviously the rest of it was edited out for obvious reasons.
Yep. If you go to IMDb, that's probably the only image that comes up on the listing for Nightstand is Dick Dietrich with this guy who is the rippling muscles and yeah.
Yes. And one more thing I want to add, and this is from a personal perspective. Back in 1996, when I first got on the internet, I actually wrote an email to the Nightstand webpage or to their email address requesting for a signed photo from Timothy Stack. And they came through. They did. Actually, I got two of them. So I got a double bonus. Yeah, I got two. The inscription on the photo, to Mike. And I'm not even kidding. This is what it says. And I'm guessing this is their informal term for fans of the show. Thank you for being a dickhead.
Oh, my God.
Not even joking. That's the inscription on the photo. Mike, Thanks for being a dickhead, Timothy Stack.
Oh, that's...
I'm guessing you have that framed somewhere.
I don't have it framed, but I have it, in a binder. It's safekeeping, let's say that. Boy, now I can just see Greg and Chico going in there. Ed Begley Jr. TARDIS's back to 1996, emailing Nightstand saying, "Can I get a dickhead photo?" I'm jealous, oh, Mike has a dickhead photo.
When we opened the It Was a Thing on TV museum, that autographed photo of Timothy Stagg's going to be in the museum.
Oh, you better believe it. That's going to be next to the statue of McLean Stevenson.
And the model of the super train.
And the model of the super train.
And the Superman balloon from the Thanksgiving Day parade peeking its head.
And the picture of Tom Ballard.
We also forgot to add a picture of Matt McCoy in the museum too, next to the Tom Ballard picture.
Hey, when I go to Buffalo in August, I'll get a sign by him.
Hey, can you sign it? Thanks. Hey, it's the guy who is in. It's the guy who is in America's Ass.
Is the guy in America's Ass?
No, the guy who wasn't America's Ass.
Oh, I thought you said in America's Ass. It's like, whoa, did we?
No.
Like, we don't know about him.
So wait, Matt McCoy shrunk and he went inside Tom Ballard's ass.
It's like the Fantastic Voyage. Absolutely.
I thought he was dead.
Oh my god!
But it's
what would Bonnie Urseth say?
I know what Bonnie Urseth would say. Nightstand with Dick Dietrich. Timothy Stack, comedy gold. It was a thing on TV.
Oh, it was a thing on TV, and it should be somewhere playing. And actually, now that I think about it, I do have an episode or two on VHS. An hour-long episode, so 4 half hours. Oh.
Great.
Oh, problem is I don't have a digitizer.
Oh.
Wow.
And also probably another big issue, I don't think I have a working VCR.
Oh. Well, I have two, so I could help.
Well, I need to find the tape. It's
Ben Minot on line one. No.
Oh, I'd put them online if I could find them. Oh, absolutely. But that's regardless. I just wanted to mention that now that since we're talking about it and it's not anywhere to be seen. So,
hey, Pluto or Stir, help us out, guys.
Yeah, I mean, the Nosy Channel already shows talk shows galore, and they added Eye for an Eye, which is a comedic court show. Oh, and Future Entry, by the way.
Oh, God, yes. The guy with the baseball bat that says Justice on it.
Extreme Akeem! Extreme Akeem! Extreme Akeem!
Extreme Akeem! Extreme Akeem! Akeem. Akeem. I'm putting that on the list right now.
I already put it on the list.
Oh, okay, never mind then.
Oh. Well, would you mind putting that to a little test? We've got a production assistant here. Cal, can you come out here, please? Give him a hand, everybody. Let's meet Cal. So, Gloria, what do you think? Pretty good-looking guy, huh?
Oh, he's very handsome, but what does that prove?
Well, it proves that you might want to see him without his shirt on. Oh. What do you think about that?
Well, he's okay.
It's okay. What do you think about that?
I just don't see it, Dick.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceMination.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceMination.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceMination.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Episode 40, Submission 171, The Cool Kids. The Cool Kids aired on Fox from September 28th, 2018 to May 10th, 2019 for a total of 22 episodes. One of the people behind It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, Charlie Day, had a great idea. Let's do It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia in an old folks home.
I would even compare it more to the Golden Girls.
Yeah, it's kind of a mix between It's Always Sunny and the Golden Girls.
Yeah, and it would have worked if it were on the FX network. Or if it were not on Fox Friday night.
Yeah, it would have worked if it didn't follow Last Man Standing.
Oh, jeez.
Well, there's more to that, I think, as well. We'll get to that a little bit later, I think. Well, who were the Cool Kids? Well, as we said, it was sort of a mix of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia in a nursing home, mixed with a little bit of the Golden Girls. And you had four true television veterans on this show. You had Vicki Lawrence. What can we say about Vicki Lawrence?
Oh.
She's an American treasure. She really is.
Yes. She really is. Is there anything she can't do?
No, really she can't. She's just absolutely amazing. She sings. She hosts. She's a comedian. She has a good one-man show or one-woman show.
She has a two-woman show.
Well, yes, I'll take it. Yes, valid point. And then you had David Alan Greer, who you would best know from In Living Color, but also, at least recently, he hosted the GSN show Snap Decision. Not an entry yet, but will it be?
Maybe.
Who knows?
Chico's on the case. And in addition to In Living Color, he was on other series, including, I believe this is an entry, and if it isn't, dang it, I'm going to make it an entry before we leave. Dag!
Yeah, it's going to be an entry. And The Secret Diary. Was he on The Secret Diary of Desmond Pfeiffer? I believe that's an entry.
No,
oh, it's definitely an entry, but he wasn't on it.
No, but... Oh, we could include future entry, Chocolate News.
Yes.
I think he was also on future entry. I believe this is a future entry, The Carmichael Show.
Yep. Yes, he was.
He was on every future entry.
We just got... We have three...
Wait. What the hell's Chocolate News?
It's what they put on the Comedy Central when The Daily Show isn't on.
Yeah, that was like early, mid-2000s.
I don't remember that. Okay.
You don't remember Chocolate News?
I don't remember Chocolate News.
It was it was the Minority Report before Larry Wilmore got involved.
Okay, well, I don't remember the show, but...
By the way, future entry, The Minority Report with Larry Wilmore.
No, The Nightly Show, because that the was... Nightly
show. No, my bad, that's right. Okay, you know, it had a billion names, but that was the one they went with, so yeah.
Right. I don't know if we can add that. That's what made 100 a popular phrase.
Keep it 100.
So.
Oh, and by the way, guys, Chocolate News was 2008, not mid 2000s. I just want to be corrected.
Okay. So now that we're all thoroughly confused, let's talk about the other two comedy heavyweights we have here. Of course, you have Martin Mull, who you might remember from, God, what don't you remember him from? The first time I saw him was on a rerun of Fernwood Tonight.
Future entry Fernwood Tonight.
Slash America Tonight.
But also, I think most people remember him as the boyfriend of Fred Willard's character on Roseanne.
Yes.
But also, among other shows, he was the lead on Future Installment. I think we're going to be saying that a lot this episode. Domestic Life.
Yep.
What do you mean you don't remember that one? We do.
Oh, by the way, Martin Mull has a guest spot on Future Installment, Get a Life.
There you go. So, Martin Mull was on that show, and he was, well, he wasn't the leader. David Al Greer was the leader.
Oh, I'd even disagree with that. I'd say David Al Greer was originally the leader, but Vicki Lawrence sort of, she made a power play, and it was actually very early in the series. But hey, we forgot one other person. We forgot Leslie Jordan, who is maybe the glue that holds all this together.
Oh, yes. He may be the best character on this show.
Yes, absolutely. And Leslie Jordan, in case you don't know, he played Beverly Leslie on Will and Grace. Not a name I'm familiar with, but I never saw Will and Grace, so I'll leave it to the experts as to who he is and how big of a star he is. But he was the best character on this show. Absolutely hilarious. The leader of the gang, at least to start, was Hank Henderson, who was played by David Alan Greer. However, you could make a case that Margaret Flynn, who was played by Vicki Lawrence, made a power play even on the pilot. Because what happened on the pilot to start is you had Hank, David Alan Greer, and Charlie, who's Martin Mull's character, and Sidney, Leslie Jordan's character. They're sitting at a table. They're grieving their friend Jerry, who just passed away, and you know they didn't want anybody sitting in his seat at their table. And here comes Vicki Lawrence. I'm going to take this seat. And they say, you can't sit there. Well, why can't I sit there? Oh, that's Jerry's seat. Who's Jerry? Oh, Jerry just died. And then what does Margaret say? Who do you think you are? The cool kids?
Oh. And
the show's title was born. You didn't see that in the pilot?
Oh, that was classic. That was classic.
Okay, no, I thought just the, oh, like you didn't notice that.
No, I was like, oh, yes. There's your title.
From there, the rest of the show is just basically the goofy antics that went on at the nursing home, the retirement home, at Shady Meadows Retirement Community, which is where everything in the show is just about set. I don't think I've seen footage of them anywhere outside of the retirement community.
Well, they were in their car, of course.
Oh yeah, there was. I do remember. Yeah, there was one episode where they did some mischief and they were trying to get out of town as fast as possible. Not just the main four characters on this show were great. The recurring characters and guest characters on this show is like a who's who of television and Hollywood of like the last 50 years. Not even joking about that. Would you gentlemen agree with that?
I'm looking at the list right now, and I am in full agreement.
Oh, yeah. Oh, the guest stars and some of the recurring cast, yeah.
Yeah.
And where to start?
Oh, boy. You know what? Start with the recurring ones, because you got a lot of names right there.
Well, we'll start. Yeah, well, I mean, where to start among the recurring characters? I think we need to start with Jamie Farr, because I know Greg mentioned earlier, watching one episode, Jamie Farr, like, stole the show.
Yes, mm-hmm. especially with those glasses.
Yes. Jamie Farr played Dudley. He was a resident of the Shaded Meadows retirement community. And he appears in a number of episodes. Again, we're going to get to that in a little bit because he stole the show in a couple of cases. Then you had Jerry Burns, who you may remember from Dear John, and also Angie Tribeca. He was John, Sid's ex-boyfriend. Oh, by the way, in case we didn't mention it, Sid's gay.
No! Couldn't tell. Could not tell.
Total shocker, I know. I'm sorry for spoiling it for everybody. Also, Charlie had a girlfriend named Kathleen, and that was played by Leslie Ann Warren, who was in the movie, a big favorite of two of us. Clue.
I wonder, shame on you.
I wonder who's the non-fan of Clue among the three of us.
Shame on you.
Dude, you need to get the DVD of Clue. It's so worth it.
I need to get a Clue.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do.
Communism was a red herring, folks.
And also another recurring character who plays a role in a number of episodes is Gorgeous George, not a wrestler. His name is Gorgeous George. He was played by Rod McCary, and he's almost like the antagonist of the TV show. He's like the sworn enemy of the cool kids.
Yeah. You might remember him from Tales of the Dark Side in the mid to late 80s. He was a recurring character, Attorney Mason on Sparks.
Oh, you don't Future remember? Entry, I believe, Sparks.
Yes. Yes. And aside from that, he was in a lot of B-rated direct-to-video movies.
But he was also Hugh Cleveland in the 1988 ABC TV miniseries War and Remembrance, the sequel to the 1983 ABC miniseries The Winds of War. Now remember The Winds of War for later on down the line. That's all I'm going to say.
I also feel compelled to add that Rod McCary, he played Judge Lloyd Elmer Clark in the TV series with a title which is maybe a little too scary to mention nowadays, Pandemic.
Yeah. Okay, also rounding out the recurring characters is Artemis Pepdani, a crossover from It's Always Sunny, as Allison, the head of Shady Meadows Retirement Community.
I also want to add Poonam Patel, who plays Poonam. She's just an employee at the retirement community. She sometimes cleans up stuff. She plays a pivotal role in at least one of the episodes we're going to mention in a little bit. But the guests, again...
Oh, boy.
The guests might be even bigger than your recurring characters. Where to start? This list is long, but again, so many quality names here. First, on the pilot, Charlie Day. Yeah, that Charlie Day. He played Chet, who was a handyman at the Shady Meadows retirement community. And he wasn't necessarily good because in the pilot, he fixed an end table and it was holding the ashes of Jerry that we mentioned earlier. And he didn't secure it well because Jerry's ashes fell to the ground and broke and spread all over the place.
Yeah. Nice to write himself as the joke of the whole thing, isn't it?
Sorry, Jerry. We miss you. Long live Jerry in a dustpan.
Moment of silence. Moment gone.
Just focusing on the big names you've heard of that were guests on this show, you had Max Gale, who was on Barney Miller.
Mm-hmm.
You had Charles Shaughnessy, who was on, among other things, he was on The Nanny. And Julia Duffy, who was on Newhart and on Designing Women.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know she's almost 70, though. Good heavens.
She keeps exceptionally well. She knows who else keeps exceptionally well. Clyde Kusatsu, who, let's be honest, what hasn't he been on?
And then there's Greg's favorite, Ed Begley Jr.
Oh yeah.
We're just gonna give Greg a moment to geek out right now.
Oh man. Well, we'll talk about his TARDIS later when we get to the episode rundown, but
Oh yes. And this is a really good episode. Oh, it was amazing episodes. We have stuff to say about that. Mm-hmm. Then you had Jack K. Harry from 227. She played Hank's ex-wife, Lorraine. But hey, guess what? Lorraine has a boyfriend, and who plays Lorraine's boyfriend?
Tar Heel in the house!
Everybody's favorite former ex-NBA player turned actor, Rick Fox.
Oh, that's amazing.
Again, is there anything that guy can't do?
Jack A and Rick Fox together. That's
comedy gold.
That's also a bit of an age difference because Rick Fox is maybe 50 or so, and Jack A is at least 60, maybe even closer to 65 or so.
Well, she keeps exceptionally well.
That's right, honey child.
Looking down, further down the list, and, oh wow, Joanna Cassidy from Who Framed Roger Rabbit was on this show as Margaret's best friend, Joni.
Where's Chachi?
He's on another episode.
Oh.
Another recognizable name that showed up as a guest on The Cool Kids is Stephen Tobolowsky as Leonard. And he's been in many movies. He's probably one of the better character actors there is. I know he was in at least one of the Garfield movies.
He was in Heroes. He is doing an awesome job on the One Day at a Time reboot.
Stephen Tobolowsky was also on The Jeffersons, the one-off version they did in front of a live studio audience about a year ago or so. And he played Harry Bentley.
What?
The next door neighbor of the Jeffersons, if you remember from the original TV show. Yes, that was Stephen Tobolowsky.
He looks nothing like Paul Benedict.
It works, though. He did a great job.
He did. Next on the list was Patrick Duffy as Gene from Margaret Ups Her Game. We'll talk about that. Oh, God. He's one of those, what hasn't he been on? Dallas? Step by Step, and two future entries, Man from Atlantis and Bingo America.
And also, and we need to add this, especially since we just talked about one of his shows last week, John Lovitz was on. John Lovitz played Kip Samgood, who was Sid's teen idol, who performed a song Margaret originally wrote, John Lovitz of The Critic. Also, another guest on the show was Robert Pine.
A.K.A. Chris's daddy.
Yeah, and he was on Chips back in the 70s and early 80s. You also have Tony Rock, who would be Chris Rock's brother, who played Tony, Hank and Lorraine's son.
Next, we have Mary Elizabeth Ellis, who played Margaret's daughter, MJ. And as you probably mostly know, Mary Elizabeth Ellis plays the waitress on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, and is the wife of creator Charlie Day.
Ah, nepotism.
Yes.
Wouldn't be the first time on the show.
No. And you also have Jennifer Coolidge as Bonnie Delacroix, Sid's ex-wife, and of course Jennifer Coolidge you would best know as
Chico. Stifler's mom!
Yep. And it's thanks to her we got the four-letter acronym from John Chell, and we all know what that means, and we're not going to say it, but you all know if you're listening.
The last person we're going to talk about is Lynn Marie Stewart. You may know her better as Miss Yvonne, the most beautiful woman in Puppetland on Pee-wee's Playhouse, but also, we just mentioned her last week, she was the planted audience member on Nightstand with Dick Dietrich. And she played Judy on The Cool Kids.
Yeah, and she also, of course, another It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia connection, she plays Charlie's mom on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
The only person they're really missing from the cast of It's Sunny seems to be Danny DeVito.
He was too busy bathing himself in Purell, probably.
or eating, you know, steaks or ham steaks covered in rum.
Rum ham.
Also, did not see Caitlin Olsen on that show.
No, Caitlin Olsen was probably too busy doing the Mick around this time. Oh, future entry, the Mick.
Future entry, the Mick. I knew that was coming.
I knew that was coming.
So yeah, I mean, this show was absolutely hilarious. And as we said, the reason it died, I think, unfortunately, is because the lead-in to the Cool Kids was Last Man Standing. And unfortunately, I don't think most of the viewers of Last Man Standing would enjoy watching a show where one of the main characters is gay. Just being honest, don't send letters.
Well, that, and also because WWE SmackDown was coming to Fox in a year, too.
Yeah, but they could have found a place for the Cool Kids. I mean, nothing against, you know, like the Bless the Hearts or some of the other shows that debuted this year, but they could have found a place for the Cool Kids. Or they could have shifted, like we mentioned earlier, put it on FX.
Yes.
It would be an FX type of show. Absolutely.
Definitely had a bit of screwed by the network, I want to say.
Yeah, well, maybe even a little bit more screwed by Vince.
Hey, I'd make a Brett screwed Brett joke here, but no.
But I mean, even if you look at the ratings, and I'm just going through the ratings right now.
I looked at the premiere ratings, and they were just phenomenal.
Yeah, almost 7 million people saw the first episode, and then from there, it peaked at about 5 million, a little bit less than 5 million, but it looks like as you get to about halfway through the run, the number then dips to about 4 million, and then by the end, it hit a low of about 3.15 million, but it seemed to average roughly in the last half of the season, about 3.5 million. So, I mean, if you look at the premiere versus the end, it did lose half of its audience. Or even if you look at from the second episode to the last episode, it did lose like 30% of its audience. So those aren't really optimistic numbers. But still, I mean, nowadays, you know, 3.5 million viewers get you a renewal most places nowadays.
Yeah, and I was looking at our friends at TV Tropes, and if you click the trivia tab, guess what I found? Screwed by the network. While it was never a ratings hit, being on the Friday night death slot and all, the Cool Kids did manage to get a decent fan following. A second season was planned, but the show got caught up in the sale of 20th Century Fox to Disney, resulting in its cancellation. Not only that, but because WWE SmackDown was on its way, there was no other room for the show on the network to continue. So yeah, little bit of column A and a little bit of column B.
And this would be like a good Disney show, I'm sorry. At least in terms of like the family values, if you will.
You know what? Do what they did with the Orville. Move it to Hulu. It worked for the Mindy Project. It could have worked for this.
It could have. But before we get to the episodes, if you enjoy the show or are more curious about this show, it's on Google Play. It's on YouTube. It's $10.
Is it on Hulu? Because again, it was produced by 20th Century, and they now own Hulu. You know what? I'm gonna
Disney.
Look right here.
Disney now. Disney now owns Fox and the entertainment side of Fox. Not the broadcasting side of Fox, I mean.
You can find it on YouTube for $10 for the season. It's on Google Play for $10 for the season.
It's on iTunes for $10.
It's affordable, and it can easily be found, and we highly suggest you purchase it. And we don't make any money on that endorsement.
Yeah, it's probably the only place you can find it, because I just looked at Hulu, and it's not there. Sad. Yeah.
And episodes aren't available on YouTube for free, because surely Fox and Disney are striking it down as fast as they go up.
Yep. You look for the show on YouTube, you're only going to find clips. They're good clips, but they're just clips.
If you go on YouTube, you'll find a lot of promotional stuff, especially a lot of stuff leading up to the premiere in 2018. Well, with that out of the way, let's look at the episodes, because, again, so many good episodes. So many good episodes. So we'll start off with the pilot. And this one was co-written by Charlie Day.
Charlie Day and Paul Frickbaum, they created the show.
Right. So right from the beginning, you have Charlie Day putting his influence in on the show beyond just producing the show or creating the show. Three friends living in a retirement community, Hank, Charlie, and Sid, mourn the loss of their recently deceased friend, Jerry. New resident Margaret sits in Jerry's seat, upsetting Hank. Coupled with being unsatisfied by the way the staff is handling Jerry's death, Hank tries to get Margaret to sit elsewhere, but his plan backfires when Sid and Charlie befriend her. After learning Jerry will be cremated, the men take up Margaret's offer to drive them to the mortuary to rescue him, but are arrested when it turns out Margaret stole the car from another resident.
Whoops.
Well, there's the driving we talked about earlier. In the end, Hank decides it's best to let Jerry go and find that Margaret has thrown a farewell party Jerry would have wanted. Impressed, the friends officially welcome Margaret as Jerry's successor. And that's how she became one of the cool kids.
Episode 2. Margaret turns 65. You would have thought she would be 65 if she's in a... Anyway, I'm thinking too much into it. Margaret is feeling moody due to it being her 65th birthday. Day and lashes out at the boys. To make themselves all feel young, Hank takes the gang to his old hangout, Ronnie's Swing Time Cafe, but when they arrive, they find the cafe has been long gone and converted into a nightclub called Twerk Lab.
Hey, guys, do you think Mr. Peanut was there twerking with LaToya Jackson?
Jeez.
After sneaking into the club, Hank, Charlie, and Margaret all have interactions that make him feel insulted and old. After reflection, the gang agrees, sorry Greg, that millennials suck, and celebrate Margaret's birthday by taking shots, which carries into the next day with a hangover for everyone.
I'm sorry, but I do agree with them. Millennials do suck. Hot take.
I'm terribly sorry that the phrase okay boomer didn't come for about another year. That's an okay boomer moment right there.
Yeah.
Episode 3, A Date with Destiny. Margaret and Sid encourage Hank and Charlie to sign up for online dating. But while Hank is a hit, Charlie is sad that no one is responding to his profile. To make him feel better, Margaret creates a fake account named Nadine, and Sid creates another one named Destiny behind her hand.
That sounds like a completely normal Sid thing to do.
Yes, it does.
Because Sid thought that Destiny would be mysterious, but obviously, as Margaret says, when you say the name Destiny, what do you automatically think of? Stripper.
Strippers.
Charlie and Hank, who lied about having lots of responses, like the sexually explicit messages Destiny sends, and problems arise when Charlie and Hank begin fighting over Destiny. Figuring out that Sid is actually Destiny, Charlie and Hank pretend to have a fight to teach them a lesson.
I wonder if Destiny worked at Zippers. Episode 4. Oh my gosh, I can't say this with a straight face because this is too funny. Episode 4. Sid comes out. Sid's son, Walt, surprises him with a visit, and Margaret is both shocked and amused to find out that Walt thinks his father is straight. Joke's on you, kid. But no, the joke is on her.
Don't when Walt... tell him. He doesn't know.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry, Walt. Spoiler.
He's gay.
But the joke is on her when Walt believes she's Sid's girlfriend. After a disastrous lunch date with Walt, which Margaret's new boyfriend, Robert, interrupts, Sid finally comes out to a dumbfounded Walt, who is happy for his father. Meanwhile, Hank needs to take an eye test to renew his golf cart license and enlist Charlie to help him cheat his way through. However, Charlie's way of helping is painful, and they are caught by the doctor. Although the doctor accepts Hank's bribe of $200 to pass him, Hank ends up losing his license after driving the golf cart into the dining room.
Double whoops. Okay, fun fact about this show. Walt Delacroix, Sid's son, is played by Travis Schultz, who, among other roles, is played Ben Smith on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Oh, is he the Marine that D-dated?
Probably.
I'm trying to.
Ben the Soldier. Ben the Soldier from the Gang Wrestles for the Troops,
starring Rowdy Rowdy Piper, who will be in a future installment next month.
Can't wait that.
But we'll talk about that later.
Mm-hmm. Episode 5: The Cool Kids Rig an Election. Oh boy!
Oh, this isn't timely.
Not at all. Tired of the home's activities, coordinator Gorgeous George, who has let the title go to his head, Margaret convinces the boys to put up an opponent in the upcoming election at the home. Hank declares the candidate to be Charlie, but Margaret forces Sid to run against both George and Charlie. After Charlie and Sid eat a lasagna meant for George, that Hank laced with mushrooms. Oh boy. And Margaret locked George into the exercise room to keep him from showing up to the elections. Hank and Margaret run against each other. An escaped George is injured when Sid, still high from the mushrooms, tackles him at the election and ends up filing a restraining order against the four. The election is canceled and the position is given to an employee who sold Hank the mushrooms.
Yes, well, this is a hilarious episode. This is one of the first ones I went to after I got the season series. The whole thing when Charlie and Sid eat the mushroom spiked lasagna, and you see Sid literally jumping off like a platform, almost like a wrestler. Oh, that's a callback to the SmackDown stuff we talked earlier. He leapt off this platform and tackled Gorgeous George. Oh, again, another wrestling name. How coincidental is all this? And
so many wrestling names.
And there was an injury that happened to Gorgeous George. His calf implants exploded. I can't say that. I'm not kidding. His calf implants exploded due to Sid tackling him during the election. And Charlie, yeah, he was just a little high on the mushrooms. During the election, he announced his engagement to a fern. No, you heard me right. He announced his engagement to a fern. He was just a little high.
Whee!
The employee that sold everybody the mushrooms, who would be Poonam that we mentioned earlier, she ended up getting the activities coordinator job by default. And actually, she did. The reason she got it is because, A, she'd do it for free, but also if she didn't take the job for free, she would have been fired for selling mushrooms to the people at the nurse at the retirement community.
Episode 6, TV Heist. Hank finds out his ex-wife is remarrying the man that she left him for. Spoilers, we're going to get to that later. And is devastated when he loses a contest for a 65-inch television to Gorgeous George, who bought a bag full of raffle tickets. Well, that's just a rip.
That's evil.
Gorgeous George just used a lot of money, and he bought like 10,000 raffle tickets. There's no justice in that, man. No justice.
He's evil. That's why he's the antagonist of this show.
Vile!
An emphatic Margaret, who has been in the same position regarding an ex-spouse, convinces Charlie and Sid to go along with a day of doing whatever Hank wants. And Hank decides to steal the TV from Allison's office. But the plan, which Hank dubs Hank's 11, goes awry. Sid gets stuck in the sauna with Allison, who's depressed her sister is getting married. Hank gets upset that the gang is only doing it out of pity for him, although he claims to be okay with his ex moving on. Spoilers, he's not. And Charlie, who bought a tank of laughing gas for the escape, to the annoyance of Margaret and Hank, accidentally opens the tank, causing Hank to ruin the TV. Hank realizes that he is still upset about his ex-wife's affair and decides to move on as well.
I remember when this first aired. This is another great episode. I need to revisit this one sooner rather than later.
It's a really good episode. I'm not just saying this because, again, Rick Fox, Tar Heel in the house.
He lies.
Episode 7, Thanksgiving at Murray's. When Margaret scores an invite to an exclusive foodie potluck for Thanksgiving, she takes Sid as her plus one, leaving Hank and Charlie to find a backup plan.
Okay, first we need to add, who directed this episode?
Fred Savage!
Fred Savage, yes.
And of course, Fred Savage has also directed episodes in the past of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. So another connection!
But also the foodies, the three main foodies, we talked about them earlier. They were Murray, played by Charles Shaughnessy, Francine, played by Julia Duffy, and Norman, played by Clyde Kusatsu. That was perfect casting on all three parts.
Indeed.
If you remember from The Nanny, maybe he wasn't much of a snob, but he played that elitist type of person. Well, maybe by, elitist, I mean rich.
Yeah.
So Charles Shaughnessy on The Nanny was one of the 1%. Probably the 1% of the 1%.
Yes, but he played this role perfectly. I mean, the casting on this show was just great. We'll get to more, actually, in the next in two episodes. But, Julia Duffy,
She is also an elitist.
Well, yeah, I mean, when you're talking about the sugar bakers on designing women. But when you talk about her role on Newhart, where she was essentially the princess.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely perfect.
That was like, those two were the chef's kiss of televised sitcom snobbery.
Oh, yes. And we should talk about the backup plan.
What was the backup plan?
Well, what Hank and Charlie end up doing is they go to Dudley, who was Jamie Farr's character.
His
apartment. Yes. And they have Thanksgiving dinner there, but it's a little untraditional. Dudley says, hey, let's turn on the football game. And they're like, yeah, turn on the football game. Yeah, let's watch some football. And so Dudley pulls out an old transistor radio and dials in to the radio station to listen to the game, irritating Hank and Charlie just a little bit.
I don't know what they're arguing about. I'd rather much listen to Kevin Harlan if he's on the call of that game.
Anything's better than listening to Joe Buck. But also, in the end, everybody ends up going to the Thanksgiving dinner held by Dudley because, again, the foodie, snobbish potluck didn't go so well, particularly because one of the requirements was a trivia contest, and they were asked a question to name, I believe it was one French cheese. It was one foreign cheese. I think it was French cheese, or it was Italian. I think it was hard Italian cheese. And they couldn't name any hard Italian cheeses, so they never got any food. The last scene, you have all four of the main characters at Dudley's Thanksgiving dinner, and you have Sid singing his own version of old-time rock and roll, but it's called Old Time Casserole. Oh my gosh, was that funny. That was brilliant. Again, everything about the show is brilliant.
Episode 8, Hank the Cradle Robber. Hello. Hank starts dating a much younger woman named Felicia, and the gang begins to suspect that she may be a gold digger who is taking advantage of Hank because of his age. But after rifling through her things, they fear this relationship may actually be something much worse. A pregnancy trap.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah. By the way, Felicia, played by Tammy Townsend, who is known as Greta on Family Matters. If you are a student of the Family Matters, then you know Greta is a little, let's just say, Greta and Felicia could very well be related somehow. Possibly. Maybe. Perhaps.
Another instant classic, episode 9. Margaret dates the Zodiac Killer.
Oh boy, here we go.
I know Greg has stuff to say about this. Go for it, Greg.
Greg has thoughts.
Margaret begins dating Carl, Ed Begley Jr., a fellow Shady Meadows resident, whom the guys think may be the Zodiac Killer. Margaret finds the accusation ridiculous, but begins wondering whether or not it may be true. Meanwhile, the guys look for the person who does not flush in the men's bathroom.
So what do you have to say about Ed Begley Jr.?
he is one scary MF-er in this episode.
But also at the same time, how he didn't win an award for this episode, I don't know. He did such a great job.
And the ending of the episode where Margaret just wants to know, is Carl the Zodiac Killer? And the end credits is just Ed Begley Jr. staring into a camera, stone-faced, and then slowly, as the credits end, has this creepy smile. And I swear to God, guys, it's going to give me nightmares for at least a month. But guys, I think this makes a lot of sense, considering the Zodiac Killer stopped killing people. Maybe time traveled, and time-traveling Ed Begley Jr. is a serial killer killing people in his TARDIS.
That runs on vegetable oil.
Yes. He's killing people that pollute the environment. He's like an evil Captain Planet.
Evil. Oh, I'm dead. Evil Captain Planet. Like I said, Ed Begley Jr. was just absolutely great in this. And every time him and Margaret talked, there was always something that made her suspicious of him being the Zodiac Killer, whether it was him offering to take her to his lakefront house where nobody will hear you scream. You can't hear an echo there. to the painting that he made in art class, which was of a lake, but there was a dead body in the lake. Oh my gosh. It's just such a great episode. Again, so many great episodes. Oh.
And here's another one. Episode 10, Funeral Crashers. Again, this is something that is dealt with when you are among the elderly. A friend of Hank's, Donna, has died, and Hank finds out his ex-wife Lorraine, who is friends with Donna as well, is gonna be at the funeral. Awkward. Margaret offers to go with him to the funeral and be his hype man to make him look good in front of Lorraine, and Sid and Charlie want to go as well, because as Charlie puts it, funerals are the ultimate after party. Worried that they'll mess up their plans to make Hank look good, Margaret forbids them from coming. They decide to come and crash the funeral anyway, but their plan hits a snag when they're misremembered as two friends of the deceased's widower. So, once again, we have the return of Lorraine, who is still very much Lorraine. And we have Sid and Charlie basically embracing their inner party animal.
Essentially, it's Sid and Charlie being Sid and Charlie.
Yep.
Being party animals, being goofy, and also going to the funeral because it has free food.
Food is always a bonus.
Oh, a lot of these episodes revolve around free food or food in some capacity. Go look at the mushroom spike lasagna from earlier. Episode 11, Charlie's Angel. When Charlie falls for Kathleen, played by Leslie Ann Warren, Margaret tries to help Charlie by attending the group Kathleen runs. Little do the divorcees know that it is a bereavement support group. Meanwhile, Hank gets stage fright while volunteering to host a closed-circuit TV show at Shady Meadows. When Sid fills in for him sharing gossip from the retirement community, Hank becomes jealous.
Who knew that closed-circuit TV news at a retirement community would be serious business, guys?
So Margaret was helping Charlie fall for Kathleen, while Sid was filling in for Hank, doing the news, and Charlie was pretending to have a dead wife, who was actually played, I guess, in story by his dead dog. Yeah, I totally get that now.
Yep.
That totally makes sense now. Okay.
Episode 12, Margaret Jr. Margaret's daughter, MJ, played by Mary Elizabeth Ellis, comes to Shady Meadows after breaking up with her boyfriend. Hank suspects that MJ is attempting to take advantage of Margaret, who bends over backwards to help her out of guilt for divorcing her father. Meanwhile, when Sid goes through Charlie's sloppy apartment looking for his wok, he resolves to help Charlie become less of a hoarder, which is easier said than done. If you look at Charlie's apartment, it is filled with a lot of stuff. I thought my room was ridiculous with the stuff I have. No, Charlie's apartment is much worse.
You're just accumulating stuff for the. It was a thing on TV Museum.
Oh, you damn well bet! I probably have this. I have the Superman Thanksgiving Day balloon like right by me. It's still not peeking out its head, guys.
I was gonna say I can see your dad going down the hall, going past your room. He sees the Superman head poking out. Episode 13: Sid's first relationship. The gang rallies around Sid to help him through his commitment issues to his new beau, John, who we mentioned earlier was played by Jerry Burns. Meanwhile, Margaret attempts to conquer her fear of flying by volunteering at the airport, but soon finds herself working beside Hank.
Oh.
Yeah.
A quote from this episode, and this is me doing a piss-poor impersonation of David Alan Greer. When you said, "I don't help people," you were right. And I need you to be wrong. So now I'm a servant of the people, baby. Step right up, stupid people who need obvious information about the airport.
Yeah, that sounds like something that David Alan Greer would say. Especially if you imagine his voice.
Yeah, and if David Alan Greer is listening to this, I'm sorry.
But we also thank you for listening.
Episode 14, The Cool Kids, Plus One. Margaret neglects the guys when her best friend, Joni, played by Joanna Cassidy, comes to visit. The guys immediately dislike Joni, and even more so when she announces she's moving to Shady Meadows. The guys devise a plan to convince her not to, but Hank ends up sleeping with her. A disgusted Margaret eventually gets her to change her mind while still remaining friends. When Joni decides to move into Shady Meadows, the guys devise a plan to convince her not to, but Hank gets distracted.
That sounds evil.
It does.
More scheming from the cool kids.
And you know what? If you think about it, I can see why Margaret and Joni are best friends. Episode 15, Mentors. As Hank and Margaret mentor an awkward high school student and help him decide on whether or not to go to the prom, Hank is forced to face a traumatic event that happened to him in high school. Meanwhile, Sid's boyfriend invites him to tour the wine country on bicycles, but Sid is mortified because he doesn't know how to ride a bike. So the student, his name is Ernie, by the way, he wants to go to the prom, but Hank's talked him out of it because he thinks he'll get picked on at the dance. Ernie arrives at the dance and is too scared to go inside, so he hides out in the bathroom. And Hank and Margaret go get him, thanks to an interaction with a slightly stuck-up student. Margaret finally sees what it's like to be a nerd, so she gets where Ernie is coming from, finally. Meanwhile, in the continuing adventures of Sid and John, we're touring wine country by bicycle, but Sid never learned how to ride a bike, so Charlie sets out to teach him. Hilarity ensues.
Episode 16, The Cool Kids Unretire. While Sid is house-sitting a fellow resident's gorgeous high-rise apartments, the cool kids get a taste of the good life, and a taste of Charlie's incredible cookies. But when Margaret decides to turn Charlie's creative cookie-making into a new business venture, everyone gets a bit carried away.
Yeah, everyone wants to be part of the in charge of the cookies.
You know, when I first read this, you know what my first thought was?
What?
Somebody laced the cookies with mushrooms. No, seriously, I'm thinking somebody did something to the cookies, but apparently they were good, and they're going to make a business out of it. Okay, I believe Family Guy did an episode about this. Not I believe. I know Family Guy's did an episode about this. Where
and the Simpsons did an episode of this beforehand.
Simpsons did it.
Damn right the Simpsons did it.
So you know what? I think we just proved that the cool kids stole it from Family Guy, and Family Guy stole it from the Simpsons. So there you go. Good job on creativity, Fox. Yay.
If anybody asks, you heard it here. Episode 17, Margaret ups her game. Margaret attempts to date the hottest guy in Shady Meadows, Gene, played by Patrick Duffy, but can't seem to rid herself of clingy Leonard, played by Stephen Tobolowsky. Meanwhile, Hank tries to sell his erotic vampire novel with the help of Sid's cousin. Now, this is another case of pitch-perfect casting here, because you have Gene, who is the hunk of the week, so to speak, played by Patrick Duffy, who is demonstrably hotter than Rod McCary. Yeah, said it. And
not to mention his hair in this episode is amazing. He's got, like, that biker haircut with the long hair and the ponytail in the back. Oh, it's just amazing.
Hey. Yep. That is a very amazing, and he has a bit of a mustache too. So he's going for the sort of elderly Hell's Angels vibe. And then you have Stephen Tobolowsky, who, let's just be honest, is Stephen Tobolowsky.
I'm surprised that Margaret is dating somebody after just recently dating Carl, the Zodiac Killer.
Well, she already got over it. It's like, well, I'll never know if Carl was in fact the Zodiac Killer, so I'm going to have to move on.
Oh.
Yeah.
Episode 18, Sid's ex-wife. Sid's ex-wife, Bonnie, played by Jennifer Coolidge, visits the home, and the gang discovers they have a great relationship. Sid soon reveals he and Bonnie have not actually divorced, as they fear it will ruin their good relationship. But this revelation could also ruin his relationship with John. Meanwhile, Margaret and Charlie's plans go to a concert to take a detour when they find out Hank has rented the van. And they discover Hank, who just got his driving privileges back after the events of TV Heist, has become a stickler for the rules.
And true to form, John becomes uncomfortable with Sid and Bonnie being together and tries to persuade Sid to get a divorce.
I wonder if Margaret and Charlie were going to see The Dregs of Humanity.
Nice.
Too bad they were already dead.
Aww.
They were
too soon.
Not soon enough.
35 years is too soon.
Episode 19, Kip Samgood's biggest fan. Sid's teen idol, Kip Samgood, John Lovitz, is in town for an autograph signing, and Margaret accompanies Sid to confront Kip about stealing a song she wrote that became a signature song. Margaret finds that Kip not only admits it, but is into her as well, making Sid jealous. Meanwhile, Hank and Charlie struggle to write a song as Charlie's six-month anniversary gift to Kathleen.
Okay, I got a problem here.
What's wrong?
Okay, Sid's teen idol Kip Samgood, played by John Lovitz. How old is John Lovitz supposed to be in this episode if it was a teen idol from Sid's formative years? I mean, I think in real life, Sid is older than John Lovitz.
Well, in real life, David Alan Greer is not how he looks in the show. So.
Well, yeah, he's not a senior citizen by any stretch of the imagination. You're right. But I think that's just a bit of a stretch because John Lovitz does not look that old. I mean, I know he's in his 60s. Yeah, he did Saturday Night Live like 35 years ago. But still, I think in terms of casting, that might be a bit of a stretch.
Yeah, John Lovitz is actually 62 now. He keeps incredibly well. I say that a lot today, don't I? And
Leslie Jordan, I think, is 64 or 65.
Leslie Jordan is 64. So Leslie Jordan's actually older than John Lovitz.
His teen idol. Go figure.
His teen idol.
Well, I got one word to say about John Lovitz being Sid's teen idol. Acting!
Genius!
Brilliant.
Episode 20, Indecent Proposal. In an attempt to date a guy way out of her league, Margaret pretends to be someone she's not. When Hank doesn't hear back from his doctor about a questionable mole, he's convinced his days are numbered, so Charlie helps him get his test results. Meanwhile, Sid avoids John, who has a very important question to ask him. So, Margaret pretends to be a Yale graduate to date a guy way out of her league who happens to be a doctor who graduated from Harvard. Because, yeah, Harvard State Yalies, apparently. Who knew?
That would be like somebody from State dating somebody from North Carolina.
That would be somebody from Duke dating somebody from North Carolina.
Oh, we don't associate with Duke people. Sorry, Gordon.
Hey, hold on a second. I do know a couple that has done that.
Yeah, he does.
And John claims to have an important question for Sid. Sid jumps to the conclusion that Sid would normally jump to the conclusion. He's going to propose. He panics, hides in Margaret's apartment, where his presence doesn't mingle well with her overly pompous date. So this episode was very Seinfeldish in that you have three different stories that all seem to come together somehow. Wonder if we ever find out about his mole.
It's not a tumor.
It's not a... Ah, great.
Dr. Klaus just solved everything. It's not a tumor.
Ah.
Episode 21. Vegas, baby! Hank is excited to give his son Tony, played by Tony Rock, the perfect wedding gift in Vegas. Until he finds out Lorraine's boyfriend, Reggie, is paying for everything. Meanwhile, Margaret and Sid's luck at the blackjack table quickly takes a turn, and Charlie hopes his old Vegas connections will come through for him.
So we have the return of Jack A and Rick Fox, and the first, last, and only appearance of Tony Rock, who seems to play a guy named Tony in everything.
You're thinking of Tony Danza.
No, I'm thinking of Tony Rock. He also plays a guy named Tony in everything. Well, can you imagine a show with Tony Danza and Tony Rock together?
And then all you need is the ghost of Tony Curtis, and you can call the show Tony, Tony, Tony. Oh, that's taken. That's taken. I'm sorry.
It feels good. Anyway.
Where's the clip from the critic last week of Bad News Mets? Okay, which one of you threw the firecracker at the little girl? Okay, which one of you was dating my daughter?
And we all know how Reggie, Lorraine's boyfriend, afforded to pay for everything at the Vegas trip. He's Rick Fox. He played for the Celtics and the Lakers. He's worth millions.
Not to mention he's got that whole acting thing to fall back on.
And still, Tar Heel in the house.
Tar Heel in the house!
The final episode. The Friendiversary. Yeah, I'm sorry. The final episode. The Friendiversary. Hank, Charlie, and Sid prepare their Friendiversary party and don't include Margaret. Noticing the tension between Hank and Sid, Margaret encourages Sid to speak up for himself. Meanwhile, Sid has set his sights on the patio for their party and attempts to convince the cat ladies to release it to them. Oh, that's also just one thing we haven't mentioned about Sid's personality. He is very timid. Very, I don't want to say squeamish, but he needs a lot of encouragement. We did see this come out in the rigging election episode. Margaret sort of snapped him out of it by saying, you've got to be tougher and you've got to be, you know, more aggressive and whatnot. And then suddenly in that episode, in the election episode, Sid was basically saying just horrible stuff about everybody. There were three ladies who were sitting at a poker table playing poker. And he said, oh, what's going on here? dogs playing poker. Can't say that, Sid. No. You know, you want to get them for their votes for the election, but also, obviously, that's just rude calling women like that dogs. So he has a tough time coming out of his shell, and obviously that's apparent here because Margaret has to encourage Sid to speak up for himself during this party.
And interestingly enough, that aired on the same day that the show was officially canceled.
Boo.
Very sad.
Very sad, but at least we can enjoy it still.
Yes. And yes, for $10, can't go wrong with that.
It's probably going to be the best $10 you ever spent, or at least spent today.
Or the best $10 spent that's not WWE Network.
And as we said earlier, the series got replaced by WWE SmackDown.
Yeah.
And that's it. Oh, it died a bad death. But actually, now I'm going to add this. We talked about the number of viewers earlier, the ratings.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the numbers were not that good. I mean, if you look at the ratings for 18 to 49, it sort of hung in that one range, even going as low as 0.6. So that's not terribly good when the key demographic, you've only got maybe about one in every 150 to 175 people watching. So, well, the show skewed older, obviously, because, you know, the four main characters were senior citizens, or at least portrayed senior citizens. But if you do look at some of the sites, it's rated very highly. I believe I saw on Google 95% of Google users that rated the Cool Kids gave it a thumbs up. So, I mean, that's 19 out of 20 people, so that's not bad. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has an approval rating of 65%, albeit there's not a ton of ratings there. So, I mean, it is, you know, it was thoroughly loved. It just unfortunately got mishandled by Fox/Disney through that transition. But also because, obviously, Fox got a WWE SmackDown, and, well, they're not canceling SmackDown. If you got to cancel SmackDown or the Cool Kids, guess who's going? The one that only gets a 0.6 rating among 18 to 49s. Well, Chico, send us home.
Yeah, the Cool Kids was just one of those shows where it had everything going for it. A superstar cast. Comedic genius writing. I think what happened was he didn't write all of the episodes, but he was running the show. And I think that sort of made the show lose some of its bite. And because of that, ultimately, the Cool Kids, it was just a thing on TV.
The Friday night time slot certainly didn't help either.
Yeah, again, screwed by the network.
And also, again, following Last Man Standing, which kind of sort of is almost like a polar opposite of this in ways.
Yep.
But enough mourning about the Cool Kids.
All right, you guys, give it a rest. Carl, I just need you to answer me one simple question. Are you the Zodiac Killer?
He was the Zodiac Killer. He is the West Wing Bandit. Admit it, you sick son of a bitch. Yes, it was me. Of course it was me. You figured it out. I got a thrill out of doing my thing and watching everyone spin out.
Well, which question are you saying yes to?
Margaret, you and me, I just don't think it's going to work out. You seem a little psycho.
Oh, no. You're not breaking up with her. She's breaking up with you. We don't let our friends date bathroom bandits that wipe their booties with the U.S. Constitution.
And FYI, I would have finished my puzzle, but I just needed more time.
You deserve better than this, Margaret. You need someone who knows how to treat a beautiful toilet.
But Carl, wait, I just need to know. Please tell me. Carl! Carl! Are you the Zodiac? Blink, for the first time since I've known you, if you're the Zodiac.
Oh,
Well, guys, not only can Ed Begley Jr. travel through time in his TARDIS that runs on vegetable oil, but he is the Zodiac Killer, and that explains a lot. He's going through time. He's trying to kill everybody in San Francisco in the 1970s. You know, that death stare in that one episode of The Cool Kids, that's gonna give me nightmares for a long, long time. But, folks, while you're trying to sit through the mind-blowingness of Ed Begley Jr. being the Zodiac Killer, we have to talk to you about all the great things going on Place to Be Nation Pop right now. Right now, we have some good stuff for you, like in the second Laugh-In Theater special, in another special isolation edition of Laugh-In Theater, host Andy Afferton is joined by Miranda Berthold, Sean Kidd, Logan Crossland, Ben Locke, and Jennifer Smith to do a live watch of the 2010 comedy She's Out of My League. The gang discusses The Moodle, Pizza Hut Express, Airport Security, Disney Obsessions, Awkward Hugs, Proper Bowling Etiquette, Hall & Oates, Pittsburgh, The Slapshot Regatta, Finishing Fast, Manscaping, Web Toes, and Going Commando. So go get the Good News Bear, file the towel of love, and make sure you don't quote-unquote show up early. And in the latest episode of the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, episode 53, National Film Score Day 2020, Glenn and Scott try to wash their taste out of another disappointing slate of Oscar scores. In honor of National Film Score Day, they review 10 scores they've never covered on the show before, selected for no reason other than they're good. But these aren't legendary scores, no. Or universally acknowledged classics. One of the selection criteria was, quote-unquote, Scott can't just pick Superman. But they make the case for why these 10 scores deserve a lesson from any Fear of Score fan or anyone interested in becoming one. Come for the 1950s scores Glenn is finally able to bring to the show. Stay for Scott's favorite score from a Sinbad film. And I gotta say to Scott and Glenn, I gotta appreciate the fact that you selected a piece from Necessary Roughness by Bill Conti. I gotta love you guys for picking any score from a movie that stars Scott Bakula. Thumbs up, guys. Also, be sure to check out the PTBN Wrestling Feed, which includes a dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE through yesteryear. The feed includes the Place to Be podcast, main event, Jenny and the Gems, Body Pressure Luck, PTB, NXT, so much more. Subscribe today. While you're at it, subscribe to Jennifer Smith's The Jenny Position feed as well. It is the new home of Geek and Sassy, Talk and Pop, Freak Out Driving, Telling Stories, and more. And also, while you're at it, check out the new North-South Connection brought to you by JT Rosero and Chad Campbell. It's the new home for Wrestling Warzone, Noel's Bard, The Extreme Three-Way Dance, Jeff Learns Wrestling, and more. And on our social media pages, the Glacier Sports logo of 2020 tournament is currently going on. There'll be 4 matchups per day, so make sure to like our tournament page on Facebook or follow us on Twitter so you won't miss a single one. And we have officially kicked off our 2020 stretch project determining the greatest WCW match ever. You have all year to do research, promote matches, and build your list. Conversation rules can be found at www.facebook.com/GWCW matches or on the Pro Wrestling Only message board. And be sure to check out placetobenation.com each and every day. We have new voices and fresh takes, preview articles, and topics in the worlds of wrestling, sports, and prop culture, including Trent SmackDown and Fox Report. This Week in WWE by John Crow, Paulie's Perspective, Jason's DVD Deep Dive, and Ben's Unpopular Opinion. And don't forget about veterans columns like Glenn Butler's Wednesday Walk Around the Web. And if you're doing online shopping over Amazon.com, be sure to click on the Amazon banner on the right side of the Place to Be Nation homepage, or use www.placetobenation.com/Amazon. It takes you right to Amazon and helps that PTBN at no cost to you. All right, so we are now on to our final topic of the day, and we once again go into the world of game shows by discussing a short-lived CBS game show from 1976 to 1977 called Double Dare. And I know what you're thinking. No, it's not that Double Dare. It's another show that just happens to be called Double Dare that was done by Mark Goodson, Bill Todman Productions in 1976. So it's not that Double Dare from Nickelodeon that comes along 10 years later. It's not even that CBS crime drama that's also called Double Dare that briefly aired from 1985. No, this is the 1976 Goodson Todman version of Double Dare, hosted by Alex Trebek. So enjoy, folks, as we discuss the 1976 version of Double Dare.
Episode 41, Submission 594, Double Dare. Double Dare originally aired on CBS from December 13th, 1976 to April 29th of 1977 for 96 episodes.
Take a risk. Take a chance. Play the game of Double Dare with the host of Double Dare, Alex Trebek.
Okay, we got a good audience with us today, so let's get right to work.
So before Nickelodeon made Double Dare into a household name, there was a little show on CBS created by a guy by the name of Jay Wolpert. It was supposed to be the return of the Great Isolation Booth Game Show. This show is basically what happens when Jeopardy and 21 have a baby. Have a game, big old game show baby.
Kind of, sort of. It gets a little different when we get to the bonus round, but we'll get to that later. So, Double Dare, as Chico alluded to, had two contestants in isolation booths, and the easy way of putting it is they were trying to guess the identity of people, places, things based on clues. They were given up to 10 clues, starting with most difficult, obviously, and then working your way to really ridiculously easy clues. And so the idea was, if you knew what the answer was, you hit your lockout button, it closed off the isolation booth of the opposing player, and you gave an answer. And if you're right, you won $50. If you're wrong, then the opponent gets to see the next clue as a penalty to the person who guessed incorrectly, because they'll never see that clue.
Woo! Yep.
Now, after a right answer is given, here's where it gets a little bit difficult. And after seeing the next clue, you have the opportunity to dare the opponent to answer. If they're right, they win $50. But if they're wrong, you get an additional $100. And if they're wrong and you get the $100, you could now double dare by seeing yet the next clue. And again, if the contestant is right, now they can get $100. But if you successfully double dare, you win $200. So you can win $350 on one clue. And given you only had to get $500 in a game, you could conceivably win the game in two clues. I don't think it was ever done in two clues, but I know there were games that it didn't take many more than maybe three or four subjects to find a victor.
Yeah, I'm doing the math in my head right now, and the most you can win off of a clue is $350.
Right. And the most you can win in a game is $650, which I think happened at least once. Because I really liked this show when GSN reran it about 12 or 13 years ago.
And they actually gave you closure, Mike.
And they actually gave me closure, unlike Beat the Clock. That's exactly what I was just going to say. GSN, they actually did show most of the episodes. They didn't show all 96, but they probably showed a good, I'd say, 70 or so. It seems like there was about a month and a half of shows that were missing. But they did show, I would say, like the first maybe about 50, 55 episodes, and then they showed the last maybe 2 to 3 weeks. But everything in between, they didn't show any of that. So don't know if that just was never converted, is lost to time, what have you. Maybe the most memorable part of the game, at least to us, is the bonus round, which is called the spoilers. And the spoilers are three PhDs whose sole job is to prevent the champion from winning money, playing a similar sort of game as to the front game, except you had 8 clues, and you didn't know necessarily the difficulty of the clues. They didn't correspond to the number. And once you saw a clue, you could either pass it or you gave it to the spoilers. If you got 4 clues past any one spoiler, you won $5,000. In the spoilers round, there's generally like 3 really easy clues, sort of gimme clues that us normies could handle. And then there's like 2 kind of sort of difficult-ish, maybe throw you off a little bit depending on when you play it. But then there's like 3 really obscure clues. So obviously, most people would give the obscure clues. There were times when a contestant felt they could get a really simple clue past the spoilers, or at least a clue that they perceived was difficult, but which in actuality was easy, and that didn't turn out very well. But about the spoilers, they had identities of their own. You had some spoilers who were very braggadocious, very cocky. You had some low-profile spoilers. Now, they're all PhDs, and they had varying backgrounds. I mean, some of them were academic types. There was one who I believe was somehow in the clergy or in religion, maybe a minister or a priest. Maybe their doctorate was in theology of some sort. You had a whole mix of different types of spoilers. I know Greg wants to speak about one of them.
Oh, yeah. I've been waiting the whole show to talk about this. Dr. Lee Franz. So here's this one spoiler who has just, what was it, like a 1970s kind of stuff? Like, not necessarily an afro, but like...
Like maybe a Jufro?
Yeah!
Yeah, he has one of those 70s Mike Brady deals, sort of.
Like a perm, there you go. Yeah,
he's kind of like a nerdy Mike Brady type. And just when you... there's a reason why we have him in the intro. With Alex saying spoiler number one is Dr. Lee Franz. Because he's like... he's, to me, like the quintessential spoiler of all the spoilers that were on this show.
Well, there were definitely a variety of personalities. I mentioned that there was a theologian there. There was one of the spoilers that was a good spoiler, I think. I mean, he didn't really come off as having an attitude, was Dr. Bradford Burns. Bradford Burns was very low-key, very quiet, a good player, wasn't cocky, never, you know, rooted against the contestants. But he, as of, I think about 2004, 2005, was still working at the University of Oklahoma, I believe. Unfortunately, I don't know what's happened to him since then, if he's retired or if he's since passed on. But he's one that shows up kind of often on the show and was a very strong player.
So one spoiler that particularly stuck out in my mind, and she is incredibly sharp, and she's going to be part of a clip that's going to come up later on in this episode. I believe her name was Kathy Asari, and she was basically the Anne Hegarty / Jenny Ryan of her day. Nothing got past her. Absolutely nothing. But she was you know, I was looking at videos in preparation of this episode, and she seemed genuinely remorseful for this sort of thing. She seems like she was incredibly remorseful. It's like, I can't help it that I know this stuff. Why are you looking at me like that? And of course, Mike and I, being very active in quizzing, we know people like that today.
Yes, well, we do, yes.
I am raising my hand and giving the Blake Shelton point here. Anyway.
Yeah, but we won't mention any names, yes. But Chico, I think I can outdo you with maybe the most polarizing spoiler of them all.
Oh, really now?
Dr. Ralph Doty.
Oh, boy.
I think he personally fed off of not just contestants disliking him, but audience members disliking him. He was not a very lovable person, in my opinion. There's one incident which sort of led me to this conclusion. This happened on the third to last episode of Double Dare back in April of 1977. I'm going to let the clip speak for itself when he gives his answer to one of the puzzles in the spoilers round. And wait for the booing at the end. You'll hear, you know, like the audience go from applauding to booing kind of quickly. Shows you how much he was loved.
Pass it, and we'll go for four in a row. All right.
Okay. Number 8.
In this play, Portia gives the speech which begins, "The quality of mercy is not strained." Somebody yelled, "Give up." Wait a minute, I've seen worse things happen. All right, here we go. Spoilers. The subject is a title, and here is your first clue. In this play, Portia gives the speech which begins, "The quality of mercy is not strained." Dr. Doty will hear your answer first. Hold it a second. Just a second now. We didn't hear it. Your microphone was not turned.
Ah!
Now you can...
You missed my performance. "It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. It is twice blessed. It blesseth him that gives and him that takes." That's from The Merchant of Venice.
Dr. Doty, you are correct. But the audience doesn't like you. That's $100 for him.
Man, what a heel.
That son of a bleep.
And actually, on the last show, Alex did call him an expletive deleted. So your little beep? Yeah, he is an expletive deleted. So it shows maybe how much Alex enjoyed him, or in terms of at least maybe Alex's disappointment that Ralph Doty spoiled a champion's winnings yet again. But also, in addition to the spoilers, we've got to talk about the contestants, because really this is almost a breeding ground for future contestants on other shows.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I can't remember. Well, there are two contestants that sort of stick out in my mind. The first one, we cannot talk about Double Dare without talking about Alan Lusher. And Mike, you know who I'm talking about right now.
Oh, he was just about as polarizing as Dr. Ralph Doty.
Yeah, but he was the king, man.
But he was the king. He was on for 8 episodes. He was one of the few, if not the only, contestant to retire from Double Dare undefeated, because he had amassed
$500.
Yeah, he amassed over $20,000 playing the game, and that was the limit at the time. But he was another one of those figures where you either liked him or you hated him. There was no middle ground.
Yeah, he's the only contestant to retire undefeated.
But also, he at least later went on to Jeopardy.
Mm-hmm.
And who's your other contestant that you remember?
On the other side of the equation, you have a guy by the name of Ray Winston, who was a really good player in the front end, and then he met the spoilers, including the aforementioned Dr. Kathy Asari, and this is when I looked at her face and, well, this is one of those times where I wish this was a video podcast, because she had that look on her face that basically said... She was on 3rd Street, and she just wanted to say, I'm sorry, I know this. I am paid to know this, and I know this, so I'm sorry.
Oh yeah, but, and also we should add, regarding the spoilers, if they got the answer correct, they did get $100. Mm-hmm. So there was financial incentive for the spoilers to to ruin the winner's day.
Yeah. Although I'm not sure she liked it at all, but I'll let the clip speak for itself.
You have now used 4 passes, but I'll tell you what you have done. You have enabled us on Double Dare to have a very clean-looking board. I mean, we got 4 passes right up there, and we know now that we are going to have to give away the remaining clues. What order do you want to try them in?
5.
Okay. I like to. You show imagination. With the aid of a Howard Hughes salvage ship, this organization reportedly recovered part of a Soviet submarine. We got to give it to them.
I know.
Okay, keep your fingers crossed. Hey, I've stood in this position before where we had to give 4 clues in a row and the contestant wound up with $5,000. There's no reason why it can't happen to you. Spoilers? The subject is an organization, and here is your first clue. With the aid of a Howard Hughes salvage ship, this organization reportedly recovered part of a Soviet submarine. We'll go to spoiler number 1, Dr. Tuckman.
The CIA.
Dr. Tuckman, you are right. You have just won $100. Let's go to Dr. Durbin, spoiler number 2.
The Central Intelligence Agency.
You are right. That's $100 that you have just won. Now, I should mention, for the benefit of our studio audience and our viewers, that spoiler number 3, Dr. Asseri, has been very sharp all week. Let's see what happens on this. Spoiler number 3, Dr. Asseri, your answer?
CIA.
That's the right answer, Dr. Asseri. Spoilers, you have prevented our champion from earning one single dollar. Congratulations to you. Our producer is very happy. But our contestant is not. However, he has $500 in cash, so we say goodbye to the spoilers. And I will tell you that $500 is a nice base on which to start building. And as our champion, you get to face another contestant.
Also, I want to talk about Ray Winston in a couple of other ways. First, Chico said he would just fold at the spoilers. We mentioned that Alan Lesher retired after being a champion 8 times and surpassing the $20,000 winnings limit. Ray Winston didn't retire. He didn't win enough money to retire from the show, but he was on the show, I believe, 12 or 13 shows. He was on for longer than Alan Lesher. It's just, I think his one loss record at the spoilers was, I want to say, maybe 1 win and, again, like 11 losses or 12 losses. So he was not the best at the spoiler round. And I think he ended up winning, I want to say, somewhere in the range of about $13,000. Not bad, but you know, if he had just even a little bit better luck at the spoilers, he could have easily surpassed $20,000. But also about Ray Winston, and this may be something you guys don't know. He was on Sale of the Century back in 1983, and he was denied the prizes he won.
How?
And what? He won a lot of prizes. I think he may have won the lot. He may have won it all.
How is that possible?
Well, if you remember, and this is still true, I think, to a point nowadays, the networks had a limit on how many game shows you could appear within a certain time frame or within your lifetime.
Yeah.
Well, there was a limit on NBC at the time that you could appear on 3 game shows. If this is your 4th or more, you're disqualified. Well, problem is Ray Winston was on Split Second. Ray Winston was on 3 for the Money. And Ray Winston was on Double Dare. That would be 3 shows. He went on Sale. That was his 4th show. On his application, he said that he was on Split Second, and he said he was on 3 for the Money, but he didn't mention Double Dare.
Oh.
So once they got wind of it, they withheld his prizes, which I believe were in the $90,000 range. And again, this is $90,000 in 1983 money.
Ooh, $90,000 is still $90,000.
But also, if I was going to forget a TV show I was on, I wouldn't forget the one that I was on for 13 episodes. I mean, even at one point, Ray Winston was on so long that when the show opened, Alex Trebek didn't come out. It was Ray Winston because he had been on for like 10 or 11 days.
Yeah.
He was like a fixture on the show. But yeah, so because he didn't disclose he was on Double Dare, and this was his fourth game show, Sail the Century being his fourth game show, he lost out on a lot of prizes. And you, if you actually do search Ray Winston, Sail the Century, you can find a legal webpage regarding that whole incident. Because I believe it didn't even get resolved until after Sail the Century was canceled in 1989. So it went on for the better part of like 6 years.
Between appeals and whatnot. I'm looking at the case right now.
I'm looking at it right now. Raymond Winston, plaintiff and appellant versus National Broadcasting Company, decided May 28th, 1981.
So yeah, that's 8 years afterwards. Jeez. So yeah, that's one of the more interesting contestants that ended up on Double Dare, that he'd actually go on to win big on another show, but in actuality, he didn't win a thing because he was a little mistaken on his contestant application. And as Chico and I can vouch for, they want the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And they make you sign it saying, yeah, to the best of my knowledge, everything above is true. Well, that's what you get when you sign a legally binding contract, if you will.
Uh-huh.
Well, some other contestants that really like stood out for me and went on to bigger and better things. Mort Kamens was on Double Dare, and he was actually, I believe, the first person to win the lot on Sail of the Century. Speaking of Sail of the Century, he was also, I believe, on the international competition that happened like in 85. All told, I think his game show winnings, at least in daytime game show winnings, are close to $250,000. And again, this is like 1983 or earlier era, so that could be worth, you know, three times as much, $750,000, $800,000 nowadays. But also you had some other contestants who were on other shows. You had Marvin Schenkman, who was on Jeopardy. I believe he was in the Tournament of Champions. But also he was a five-time winner on Split Second and won a car back in 1975, right at the end of its run.
Yes, and that episode does in fact exist.
Oh, yes. That was one of the first Split Seconds to appear out in the trading circuit. You also had Sarah Beth Rothfeld, who went on the Double Dare as Sassy Rothfeld. And you're saying, who is Sarah Beth Rothfeld? Okay, you're not saying who is Sarah Beth Rothfeld.
Hey, Mike. Who is Sarah Beth Rothfeld?
Why, I'm glad you asked. Sarah Beth Rothfeld actually went on to Face the Music about 4 years later, 3 to 4 years later, and she actually is the only champion to have won 10 games on Face the Music, won what? The car. Yeah, she retired as a 10-time champion, won the Datsun, and won whatever the bigger prize was, whether it was a trip around the world. I think it was a trip around the world. So, yeah, she's the biggest winner in the history of, oh, yeah, I forgot, future installment, Face the Music. And she also later appeared on, not an installment yet, but I'm sure we may rectify that soon. She was on Match Game in 1998.
I shall look, but I think you're right there.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we haven't added Match Game 98, but it's just a matter of time.
Another Jay Wolper joint.
So what happened to Double Dare? Why did it get canceled after essentially 20 weeks? It was just too smart of a TV show for a daytime audience.
Yeah, it was also a bit too complex for a daytime audience as well. Jeopardy proved that you can be a very smart daytime TV show. Art Fleming made that show work. Double Dare basically took the Jeopardy formula and kicked it up a notch.
Yeah, and that's why it's kind of like Jeopardy meets 21, basically.
But also, on top of that, if you remember back in the 70s, housewives were a popular thing. They were. I mean, I don't want to sound sexist, but back in the 70s, housewives were reasonably common. And you need to remember that, not necessarily about the housewives, but if they're doing chores, taking care of the kids, cleaning the house, what have you, they're not really necessarily watching the TV. They'll be listening to it. And this is one of those shows where the player one factor, especially if you have like a vacuum running or some noise in the background.
This is a very visual show.
It's a very visual show. There's not a good play along factor unless you're watching. So it is just too smart for its audience. But also, I just find it interesting. I believe one potential replacement for Double Dare in 1977, and this is actually going to be coming up in a future episode, is CBS did a pilot for Jeopardy, which became Jeopardy, that was on NBC in 1978 and 79. We're not going to get into details about specifics here, but that was a potential replacement, was what you saw on NBC in 78-79, I'm pretty sure was made to replace Double Dare, just based on when the pilot was recorded. And also, again, like we said, Double Dare is at a similar level, if not a higher level, than Jeopardy. So maybe Jeopardy was like a light version. Maybe it might have worked, but who knows? It didn't make it past pilot stage, at least in 1977.
I want to take a look to see what time it aired, because that might have had a lot to do with it. If you remember from, 1976 to 77.
10:30.
Yeah, that definitely would not have worked. Because, again, who is the audience for a show like Jeopardy? College students. When did that air? Over their lunch breaks. Right?
Yes, no, you're right. Jeopardy, I think, aired...
Jeopardy aired later in the afternoon at your 1 or 1:30 block.
Well, back in the 70s, back in the 60s, it aired at 11:30.
So, yeah, it's just right around the middle of the afternoon.
Well, actually, by in 1970, it was airing at noon. So, yeah, I mean, pretty much sometime in the late morning, you'd have Jeopardy, which would coincide with lunches and time off at work, possibly. Not that maybe necessarily there are a lot of TVs in workplaces in 1970, but yeah, I mean, they had the right idea in that case. Double Dare was 11 a.m. and then it got pushed to 10 a.m.
Yeah, that's not conducive to a lunch schedule.
Especially the 10 a.m., yes. And that was just for the last about month and a half of the run. But also, if you look at the original airtime of 11, it did air after a certain little show which aired for an hour called The Price is Right. So it had a lead-in.
It had a very good lead-in. It had to have been up against something to, you know, sort of...
Another little show called Wheel of Fortune.
Yeah.
So we're talking about two shows that, 43 years later are still on the air. Which is kind of absolutely mind-blowing.
So, okay, let me get this straight. So if Double Dare had been replaced by Jeopardy, would Jeopardy have gone against Wheel of Fortune?
No, because Double Dare had moved to 10 a.m.
Okay.
By March of 77. It would have been going on against... Or it would
Sanford
have been going
and up, Sun reruns.
Yeah, it would have been going up against Sanford and Sun reruns.
Yeah, because I don't think NBC would be happy with Merv having two shows against each other.
Well, no. I don't think Merv would be happy with having two Merv shows going up against each other.
And even so, again, 10 o'clock is not conducive to a hard quiz. 10 o'clock is sort of fluffernutter time. Look at what was on at 10 o'clock. Both before and after the move. The Price is Right. And then on NBC you have the Hollywood Squares, which was not a hard quiz at all. It was celebrities having a party. I mean, both Price is Right and Hollywood Squares, really good shows. But Double Dare stuck out like a sore thumb.
Yeah, it was too smart for its own good.
Too smart for the room, as it were.
Yeah.
Well, guys, Double Dare, though, would certainly have a legacy that went far beyond the lifespan of the show, because the theme music for this show What a lady.
We haven't talked about that.
Yeah. The theme music, the you might recognize on another show. Because in another year or so, NBC would premiere a little show from Mark Goodson, Bill Todman Productions, hosted by Jim Perry, called Card Sharks. And they would reuse the opening theme from Double Dare on that show.
Not only that, they would Fremantle would remix said theme music for the 2019 version.
Yes.
Yeah, so the music you hear on Card Sharks nowadays, its great-grandfather was the original Double Dare music back in 1976.
That's a 40-year-old track y'all are bopping to.
And not only that, but the sound effect for the opening of the clue board and the isolation booths would later be used for the Price is Right's Penny Ante and Vendo pricey games, as well as the bonus round level wind-up sound on Jack Barry's The Joker's Wild.
Yep.
And also they used a truncated version of the famous losing horns from The Price is Right for bonus round losses.
They sure did.
Yes, they did.
As you heard in the earlier Ray Winston clip.
But guys, if you do want to watch the 1976 Goodson Todman version of Double Dare, Amazon Prime has the first 20 episodes of the series available for streaming.
And that does include all 8 of Alan Lusher's episodes.
Yep.
And also Dr. Lee Franz.
No answer.
One of the other things about Double Dare that really stood out, it had an electronic game board. And really, I don't think anything up to that time compared to this. I mean, Family Feud's kind of, sort of, but that wasn't necessarily electronic because I believe the different characters were like...
They basically used a bus tote.
Yeah.
A really large bus tote.
Are you talking about Family Feud?
Yes.
Yeah, Family Feud was like that. It had like a neon sticker on one side, and there was like a switch to activate it. This, I believe, was fully electronic, and I can only imagine how long it took to not just create this, but also to put the clues in. I'm sure they could just generate clues by typing it up, but again, 1976 technology is a lot different than 2020 technology. So it was very mind-blowing for back in the day. And even the animation of the opening logo, the animation of the logo in the show's open on that electronic board, that was pretty cool for 1976.
It really was.
But also, another thing that we're going to mention, and we're probably going to end on this, is... one real famous person besides Alex Trebek was an alumnus of this show. And she would go on to be on a couple of shows. She'd later go on to be on The Fall Guy and also Night Court. We're talking about Marky Post. She was a writer on Double Dare.
Really? I knew she was a big game show fan, but...
Well, yeah, I think she was a researcher or writer for Split Second before that. Marky Post definitely cut her teeth on game shows back in the 70s, yes. Well, also, she talking about Card Sharks earlier, she also was a dealer on Card Sharks for a brief while on the original version.
She was, yes.
So it's all come full circle.
Yes, she has. Well, Double Dare in 1976, some of the sounds and music would live on. Certainly the title would live on another show, on another network in 8 years. And it was a bit too smart for the room. But whether or not Ray Winston wants to remember it, it was a thing on TV.
Indeed it was. As always, remember, we're at www.itwasathingontv.com. You can find prior episodes there. You can find our social media links. Don't forget, please like and subscribe. Please rate and review. And as Chico would say,
don't forget to share, because sharing is caring.
Exactly. Well, until next week, when we have two more great episodes. And one of these is a Greg episode. We'll just get it out of the way. Actually, you can make a case that both episodes are Greg episodes.
Oh, definitely.
I'm looking at the calendar now. Yes, both of them are Greg episodes.
And the second one is going to be all me, baby.
The first one, I'm going to help you out. The second one, definitely all you.
No, I think we can both help out on both shows.
Oh, definitely.
Because I think both of us have stuff to say about at least the second show.
Yes, we do.
Especially the last subject of episode two. And you know what I'm talking about, Mike.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. Oh, yes, I know what you're talking about.
I think we all know what you're talking about.
Yes. But that'll be next week. Thank you, as always, for listening. Thank you to Greg for assisting, and thank you to Chico for assisting. I'm Mike, and until those new episodes pop up, please have a great remainder of the week. Thanks for listening.
50-50 tie, our champion and our challenger. As we go to this subject, it is a thing, and here's the answer, and here is the first clue. The more horizontal this thing is kept while in action, the more likely you'll get what you're after. Number two. In the film Walkabout, the lead male straps one against his thigh with his loincloth. Next clue. To use one properly, grip it firmly with three fingers at the curve near the tip. Number four. If yours weighs more than 8 ounces, don't expect it to arc back after you've used it. John?
A bow.
Wrong. Eileen, he gave us an incorrect answer, so you get a look at a penalty clue. Elia Kazan directed a movie with this thing as its title, about a murder that backfires on the guilty parties. Free guess for you, Eileen.
A bow.
Wrong. Wrong answer from both of you. We continue. According to legend, these things were sent out to capture and return the sun. To this day, they mimic that action. Clue number seven. For use in warfare, hooks placed at the ends of these things become lethal as they whirl into the adversary. John.
Boomerang.
You're right. You take the lead. You go to $100.
Wow! No answer.
Ha 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 ha